all part of my life, and that my imagination could give me security. Now it seems that rows of razor teeth and deep searing sores are all that there is, and I cannot escape from this dismal keep, even in dreams. How slim my chances really are. Perhaps I should simply give up rather than continue this pointless struggle. I fight the vision of 1,400 miles of wet desert separating me from the first oasis. I try to forget my fear of the attacks. I struggle with my weariness of pumping up the raft and divert my nerves from the caustic cuts on my back and knees. Exhausted, I find sleep for another hour. My dreams are broken again by the Dorado flapping outside. Grabbing my gun, I rip open the tent flap. There is no attack. The water lies still. My eye catches sparkling lights on a black horizon. A ship. She looks to be traveling across my bow, maybe 4 miles off. I rummage for my flares and gun. I drop in one of the fat red babies and clink the chamber closed. I whisper to her, "Do good by me now. Stand, point the wide barrel to the heavens, and let her rip." An orange sun pops into the sky, belches smoke, and softly illuminates a small parachute as it dangles toward the sea. Swinging in its gentle descent, its light falls as a halo over the bleak waters 200 feet below. The lights of the ship are at a closer angle. I hoop and holler, "She's seen me!" I wait and then let flare number 2 fly. My spirits blaze with the light. My weak legs begin to dance. I watch the ship approach. No more sharks. Home. Fresh Dorado. Queen of the seas to the crew. I duck inside and begin throwing my knife, water, and goodies into the sack. The ship may leave my raft behind. I at least want my equipment, the only physical things I have left in the world. What a relief to forget about sipping water. I take several healthy swallows as I glance out. A fine mist is coming down. The ship is approaching a little to the south of me. Glowing ports and a brightly lit bridge emanate warmth and companionship. Saved. 14 days and I'm saved. I fire a third flare. "I'm up here," I yell. Visions of my rescue race into my mind. "Where are you bound?" the trim bearded captain asks. "Looks like wherever you are." "I guess that's true enough. Gibraltar's our next stop." I present him with the strings of fish. "Sorry to have chopped them up like this. Had I known you were going to pop by for dinner, I'd have sliced them into proper steaks. I got duties to attend to. You get some rest and I'll see you on the bridge when you feel up to it." I should recover fast. I was in pretty good shape before I left. I pause and reflect. I've been damned lucky, haven't I? Haven't I? The fantasy recedes as I fire off a hand flare. My immediate world is lit up like day. My fish escort can be easily seen through the water. Their bodies smoothly undulate, seemingly oblivious to the idea that their companion will soon disappear. With such a flat sea, perfect visibility, and the ship only a mile off, the watch couldn't miss seeing me. The ship's bow continues to cut purposefully toward the lightening dawn. Her wake is highlighted as it sweeps astern under her escaping cabin lights. A smooth, roiling path, the rumble of engines, and a plume of smoke trail behind. The mist is heavy now, almost a light rain. My excited heart has been pounding off the cold. Now the sagging of my enthusiasm allows this chill to creep under my skin. Dark bands of clouds are lit by the rising sun just under the horizon. I set off another hand flare, still confident that I have been seen. Wakes from the ship rock the raft, and I ride them out, still standing. He'll turn and approach to windward. As the flare dies, a tall burning ember, like a devil's fire cone, stands in my hand. I throw it down, smoking and sizzling as it hits the surface, then groaning and boiling as it sinks into the depths. There is a faint smell of diesel in the air. Perhaps I have a last chance. Someone may be on the afterdeck. I fire a fourth parachute flare. Then I collapse. She's missed me. "Fool, fool, damn fool. You've wasted 6 flares. Count 'em, 6, you turkey." The water bottle shows that you've downed a pint of hard-won stock. You were cocky. You were wasteful. You confused dreams with reality. A light frigid shower falls upon my body as I stand and watch the horizon until only a wisp of smoke can be seen. I should have realized that I wouldn't be saved by the first ship to pass my way. The Baileys had to wait until the 8th. It is not good business to bank on a check that is supposedly in the mail. I will be saved only when I feel the steel of a deck under my feet. Dougal Robertson said not to count on shipping. Rescue will come as a welcome interruption of the survival voyage. Typical bloody British understatement. Ranting and raving is my style. After a few minutes, my Irish fire is as cooled and drowned as the dead flare now a mile below me. February 19th, day 15. Things could be worse, I suppose. Perhaps he did see me and will radio for air assistance. I flip on the EPIRB. I doubt an aircraft will arrive, but I may be closer to shipping than I expected. My spirits are good enough to be cynical, even if I'm not smiling. I chide myself. No coffee for this morning's breakfast? Dreadful state of affairs. Will rescue come before another shark attack? Hopes, hopes. But I face the reality that I will probably have to battle with more sharks. Since losing Solo, I have tried to save my energy, but the thoughts that bounce around in my brain are wearing me down. I'm too aware of how full of clichés my thoughts seem to be. The clichés one would expect from a struggling survivor. There are the promises to the cosmos that if only I am let out of this mess, I'll surely be good from now on. There are the constant dreams of food and drink, the aching loneliness, the fear. How I would like to take command of my situation, to entertain myself with enlightened thought, to heroically forget pain and fear, to keep control. Perhaps that kind of heroism exists only in novels. If there is any enlightenment that I have been awakened to, it is that men's minds are dominated by their little aches and pains. We want to think that we are more than that, that we control our lives with our intellect. But now, without civilization clouding the issue, I wonder to what extent intellect is controlled by instinct, and culture is the result of raw gut reactions to life. I was brought up with the idea that I could do anything, be anything, survive anything. I want to believe it. Try to believe it. As I nibble my morning meal on the 15th day, the battle with the Dorados begins again. Their powerful jaws snap at my hands and feet. I try to curl up on my cushion to soften the blows, and occasionally I drive them off. As daylight fills the sky, they dart off to hunt, returning every now and then to group with others and butt the raft. Flying fish burst from the water in the distance. They skitter for 100 yards or more, weaving this way and that, their wings banking to the turns and their tails flickering like little propellers. Dorados race off and leap after the flyers, their favorite prey, or they shoot out of waves in high arcs just for the fun of it. At sunset they return, as if my raft is the school's rendezvous point. I'm continually faced with hard decisions. Each time I fish, I risk damaging the spear gun and the raft. If that happens and I am not rescued in short order, I may die. On the other hand, I may die if I don't fish enough. Every time I decide on taking action, I run through the possible results to try to rationally decide on the best thing to do. But I am finding that all decisions are a two-edged sword, that any action may both benefit me and harm me. In the final analysis, everything is a gamble. During their attacks, I have speared 10 Dorados. Some meat from the first Dorado I caught still hangs in the butcher's shop. I don't want to kill them needlessly. I wish that they could intuit this and leave me alone. They attack at dawn and dusk. I spear 2 of them securely and pluck them from the water. Their eyes meet mine as I hold their kicking bodies away from the raft. Frustrated, I yell at them. There, is that what you want, stupid fish? They tear free, ripping large holes in their fins and back. It does not seem to faze them. They return. I can feel a small tear in one of the ballast pockets, and I fear that the fish will not stop until they have destroyed me. I try to convince myself that their attacks are more pragmatic, that they are after the barnacles under me. Growing on the bottom of the raft are the beginnings of gooseneck barnacles, so named for their long, tough stalks from which hang their lumpy black bodies. The adults are armored with bright, white, yellow-rimmed multiple shell plates that fit together like a puzzle. The baby barnacles on the raft are only about 1/3 of an inch long and have no hard shells. Once, Napoleon Solo was heeled over on the same tack for 2 weeks. Even though Solo sailed like a wizard, a farm of barnacles sprouted on the smooth paint underwater, above her antifouling. Anything floating in the sea is an island. Flotsam allows barnacles and weeds to grow. These act as nurseries for many animals and plants and attract small fish, which in turn attract larger fish, including sharks, and birds. When Chris and I left the Azores, we found an 8-inch cube of styrofoam floating in the sea with a 14-inch fish parked under it. We lifted its home and the fish swam about in circles, completely confused. We picked up fishing floats and lines cast adrift for some months. Every inch of floating paraphernalia housed a cluster of barnacles 2 inches long, as well as crabs, fish, worms, and shrimp. I've seen a mere strand of weed that had been swept out into the Gulf Stream, accompanied by reef fish that had drifted with it over 1,000 miles from their home. My raft and I are a large island by comparison. It is heartening to see the ecology develop. Meat, especially the fish sticks of Dorado, is very high in protein, but most vitamins are found in the photosynthesizing organisms. Plants and the animals that feed on them, such as barnacles and triggerfish, yield more vitamins than the meat of the carnivorous Dorados. Organ meats are also higher in vitamins because they process the food that the fish digest. Experiments have shown that even without any vitamin C, a person shouldn't get scurvy for 40 days, but any number of diseases or organ failures can result from lack of other vitamins. I hope the barnacles, triggers, and fish organs will provide enough. The line that trails to the man overboard pole is made of twisted strands with long, spiraled furrows that make a good field for barnacle growth. But every good thing has a price. The growth feeds me, but slows me down, and the developing food chain will attract sharks. In addition to the little ecosystem developing around my raft, I am constantly surrounded by a display of natural wonders. The acrobatic Dorados perform beneath ballets of fluffy white clouds. The clouds glide across the sky until they join at the horizon to form whirling, flaming sunsets that are slowly doused by nightfall. Then, as if the sun had suddenly crashed, thousands of glistening galaxies are flung out into deep black night. There is no bigger sky country than the sea. But I cannot enjoy the incredible beauty around me. It lies beyond my grasp, taunting me. Knowing it can be stolen from me at any time, by a Dorado or shark attack or by a deflating raft, I cannot relax and appreciate it. It is a beauty surrounded by ugly fear. I write in my log that it is a view of heaven from a seat in hell. My mood follows the sun. The light of each day makes me optimistic that I might last another 40, but the darkness of each night makes me realize that, if any one thing goes wrong, I will not survive. My rapidly shifting moods chase one another until I feel completely confused. Writing helps to keep things in perspective, but I wish for a companion who could tell me if I am dreaming or even sane. If I crack, I may waste my flares, or worse. My wandering mind often stumbles upon words from what seems like lifetimes ago. Fragmentary pieces of my past fall snugly into place to form a pattern and give depth to things that at the time were merely whimsical. My mother and I were speaking of the dangers of single-handed sailing. "No, I only wear a harness if it's too nasty out to trust my hold on the ship," I said. "The things get in the way. Give me something else to get tangled in or to trip over, right over the side." "You should at least wear a life jacket," she scolded. "If I do go over and watch my boat sail off into the sunset," I told her, "I don't relish the idea of hanging about for several days while my flesh is slowly picked by fish like some kind of oceanic bird feeder." She was not amused, and harumph. "After all the trouble I had in giving you life, you had better not give up that easily." Her words haunt me. "You have to promise me to hang on as long as you can." It was a promise never made, but it is being kept just the same. Not long before I left Solo behind, I read a Robert Ruark novel, Poor No More. The grandfather spoke to the book's hero when he was a boy, something like, "Look, I know I'm going to die soon. Let's not make a big fuss about it. It don't matter. But look at your father. He never took one chance in his life. Look where it's gotten him. Don't do that. Have the balls to kick life around a little bit. Make it hot." My legs are too weak and wobbly to kick life around. I've taken those chances, and where have they taken me? This vagabond is bushed. Still, I must try to keep on course until a safe anchorage is reached. When I was 16, I lay in bed with blood poisoning in my foot. Instead of dwelling on my ailment, I told myself that at least I had a clear head, strong arms, and one good leg. About me lie the remnants of Solo. My equipment is properly secured, vital systems are functioning, and daily priorities are set, priorities not to be argued with. I somehow rise above mutinous apprehension, fear, and pain. I am captain of my tiny ship in treacherous waters. I escaped the confused turmoil following Solo's loss, and I have finally gotten food and water. I have overcome almost certain death. I now have a choice, to pilot myself to a new life, or to give up and watch myself die. I choose to kick as long as I can. High noon. The sun sizzling overhead roasts my dry skin. I sponge seawater onto my torso and let small pools collect in its hollows until they disappear. Resting on one side to let my back and upper side heal, I envision myself sprawled on an Antiguan beach. In a moment, I will arise and fetch a cold rum punch. No need to yet. Plenty of time. Strips of fish have been drying on the canopy. Thin layers of fat under the skin glisten in the sun. The outsides are dried to a bronze color. They are slightly salty and spicy, rivaling the best sausage. February 21st, day 17. Things seem to be improving. For 2.5 days, there have been no shark raids. The morning and evening attacks of the Doradus have been less ferocious. Either that or I'm noticing them less. A shower broke yesterday's heat. I opened my mouth as I did when I was a child trying to catch snowflakes. The rain wet my face, and I trapped another 6 ounces in my Tupperware box. I've begun to rebuild my water stock. When I first saw the squall approaching, I pulled up the painter astern and let the precipitation wash the barnacles clean. With my knife, I easily peeled 3 or 4 ounces of barnacles from the line. Mixed with rainwater, they made a slightly crunchy soup, which I drank from my Tupperware box. I couldn't get the idea of a McDonald's Quarter Pounder or McBarnacle Burger out of my mind. Soaked with salt water in a plastic bag, the remaining raisins had fermented until they bore little resemblance to the original fruit. But they made a final treat for my banquet. They were my last food from terra firma. Grinding hunger is not what plagues me now. It is slow starvation. My body knows what it needs. For hours on end, fantasies of sweet ice cream, starchy baked bread, and vitamin-rich fruits and vegetables water the mouth in my mind, though my real mouth long ago gave up its vain attempts to salivate. Not an evening passes without dreams of food. When I feel confident, I dream of the future. My friends are building homes. We carry long timbers and heave them into place. We stop to lunch from tables piled high with bread and fruit. Often I fantasize about opening an inn in Maine where good food will be served, sherried crab and flaky pie shells, chocolate pies, cold beer. We eat slowly, calmly, overlooking the placid indigo waters of Frenchman Bay, where mountains stubbornly shoulder the cold Atlantic. I pool my energies to tend my equipment. I lash mirrors and a small strobe light to the man overboard pole. I tie up the leaky observation port on the canopy. My navigation puts me about 1/5 of the way to the Caribbean islands. It's a sobering realization. Can I last another 60 days? My mind turns to the unbearable suffering the Baileys must have known. I cannot imagine over 100 days of this. But then, what are those whose whole lives are spent in starvation? I envision my own inn coming at any moment with a snap of jaws, but somehow I feel fated to survive. I lost everything I owned with Solo. But it is intriguing to think of what it will be like to start over again with no worldly goods, with only experience. On calm days, I can move my weight away from the windward side without fear of capsizing. I sit across from the butcher shop where my fish hang from their clotheslines. This is the one spot in the raft where I can sit almost upright. From here, I can easily tend the still every half hour, watch part of the horizon, write, and navigate. Time and again, I plot my possible position. 60 days. It seems impossible, but many things that are hard to believe do happen. George Bracey is a friend of mine back in Maine. He's one of the old-timers, a lobsterman and clamber in his younger days. Some folks call him the geezer. Like most men of the sea, George can spin any number of wild and barely believable yarns. There's the one about the time he roller-skated down Cadillac Mountain, back when clumsy steel wheels were advanced technology. Or the one about the man he saw who jumped from a height of 1,000 feet without a parachute onto a mattress below, wearing only a jumpsuit with flaps of cloth between the legs and arms. By the time I knew him, George was slowed by arthritis. Was paralyzed from the waist down for 12 years. Doctor said I'd always be that way. Then one day I was sitting on a log, cutting up some stove wood, when I fell off, and lo and behold, I could walk just fine. It's hard to tell when men are remembering things as they were, and when they have innocently constructed or elaborated on memories. But every now and then the geezer would surprise the skeptical. You might get a glimpse of an old newspaper clipping titled, "Local Lobsterman G. Bracey Roller Skates Down Cadillac." Or spy an old photo of a barnstorming acrobat clothed only in a baggy jumpsuit with the caption, "Calls himself Batman." Who was to say what is not true and what is not possible? Chip Ho! I glance up and there she is, close by, a sweetly lined red-hulled freighter with white whale strake and shapely bow slicing her way right for me. It's incredible that I haven't seen her sooner. They must have spotted the raft and are headed over to check it out. I load the flare pistol to satisfy their curiosity. As it shoots skyward and pops, the vessel cuts the distance between us at 12 to 14 knots. The flare isn't as bright as it would be at night, but the crew can't miss its smoke and flame hanging in the air. If anyone is looking, it is impossible for him not to see me. The raft isn't disappearing into any troughs, and I have the full ship continually in view. I light an orange smoke flare that hisses and wafts a tawny genie downwind, close to the water. My eyes search the bridge and deck for signs of life. The ship is now so close that if a deckhand scurries into view, I will be able to tell what he is wearing. But the only thing moving is the ship itself. I pull in the man overboard pole, extend it high over my head, and wave frantically. I shriek above the soft murmur of the raft gliding over the water, the shush of the ship's bow wave and the beat of her engine. Yo, here, here, bloody hell, can't you see me? I yell as loud as I can until my throat cracks. I know that my voice must be drowned out by shipboard clamor. Still, it is a relief to break the silence. She steams on. Such a lovely ship. Too bad. Within 20 minutes she has disappeared over the horizon. How many others can possibly pass so close? Most likely none. How many will pass that I will not see? How many won't see me? In this century there are few eyes aboard ships. In heavily traveled sea lanes where collision is an immediate threat, a good watch is kept. Navy ships also have the manpower and the desire to keep a constant lookout. But in the open ocean, the captain of a merchant ship may keep only one of his few crew on the bridge to take a cursory glance around the horizon every now and then. Maybe there's an eye on the radar. Maybe the VHF radio is flipped on to channel 16 while the vessel charges blindly over the ocean under the automatic pilot's command. And even if there is a watch, after seeing that no ships are in view, he turns his attention back to his novel or girly magazine, or he steps out onto the bridge to take a smoke in the shade. My raft would be hard to spot even if a ship had been notified. A 250-foot red freighter didn't appear to my eyes until it was almost upon me. What chance does my bubble have of being seen? Perhaps I should stay awake at night when flares are most effective. But I must stay awake in the day to properly tend the still, and a good watch at night would cut my precious water supply. I try to calm my frustrations by repeating, "You're doing the best you can. You can only do the best you can." One thing is clear. I cannot rely on others to save me. I must save myself. The freedom of the sea lures men, yet freedom does not come free. Its cost is the loss of the security of life on land. When a storm is brewing, the sailor cannot simply park his ship and walk away from it. He cannot hide within stone walls until the whole thing blows over. There is no freedom from nature, the power that binds even the dead together. Sailors are exposed to nature's beauty and her ugliness more intensely than most men ashore. I have chosen the sailor's life to escape society's restrictions, and I have sacrificed its protection. I have chosen freedom, and I have paid the price. The last wisp of smoke lies faint on the horizon where the ship disappeared. Despite my rationalization, I am bitterly disappointed. I am not angry, but I am ready to be enslaved by shoreside life for a while. Words of the old man in the sea come to me. If only the boy were here. If only the boy. I need a rest, another set of eyes, the companionship of another voice. But even a companion would not improve my chances. There would not be enough water for two of us. Perhaps flying a kite will increase my visibility. I cut a swatch from the space blanket and make a diamond-shaped bird, using a couple of battens from the piece of mainsail as a cross frame. It's pretty heavy for its size, and needs a tail. I can't get it to fly from the raft, but maybe I can perfect it by the time I get to the shipping lanes. It is quite effective as a water gutter. I tie it up to the back of the tent, where it catches most of the spray that dribbles through the observation port. A proper kite would be a valuable piece of emergency equipment, a bright beacon flying hundreds of feet above the ocean, but mine is destined to assist in keeping things dry, which helps me heal. Again the sun sets, The fish attack. I pump up the raft's slowly deflating tubes, eat my fish sticks, search for rest, and find only sleep. Again in the night, a shark comes. It rips across the bottom with astounding speed and tears me from comfortable fantasy. As it scrapes under a second time, I strain to detect its form in the depths, but cannot. It is gone, and for another windless night, the raft flops and awaits the final attack. Until now, I have referred to my raft simply as the raft. I decide that it must have a name. I have owned two inflatable dinghies in the past, and I jokingly named them Rubber Ducky 1 and Rubber Ducky 2. It only makes sense to continue the tradition. Therefore, I dub thee Rubber Ducky 3. In the morning, I crawl around the top of Rubber Ducky, sliding my hands over the rubber, feeling for signs of deterioration. The bottom feels good, at least as far under as I can reach, but there are several divots in the bottom tube around the gas cylinder. Perhaps they've been there all along, or perhaps a shark has been chewing on my raft. The gas cylinder hanging under the raft still worries me, but I can't think of anything to do about it. Above the water, the tubes are beginning to roadmap with cracks from the baking sun. The exterior handline is so tight in spots that it chafes on the tubes. When the raft was tied to Solo, the force from the sea's attack must have yanked it through the anchoring points. With all my might, I try to loosen and readjust it with no effect. The orange pigmented waterproofing of the canopy has been bleached, beaten, and washed off. It no longer keeps water out of the raft, and any rainwater picks up small orange particles. Trying to swallow it is like forcing down another man's vomit. If I could have effectively collected water from the past showers, I'd be about 6 pints richer. I curse it. Robertson says that one can absorb up to a pint of undrinkable fresh water by enema, but I have no way to give myself one. The sun rises and the bake-off begins again. My past continues its procession before my mind's eye. There is no freedom to get on with my future. I am not dying and I am not finding salvation. I am in limbo. In my mind, a cool stream winds through tall, verdant trees. I look into the bubbling water as it tumbles over a rocky bottom. The smell of fresh biscuits wound around sticks, browning over a campfire, fills my nostrils. It is really just the smell of drying fish. I see a majestic harbor full of yachts. Solo is there. The ragged volcanic peaks of Madeira rise in my mind. Eons ago, they grew from the sea bottom and blasted out upon the surface. Catherine and I ride the bus that rattles its way around the torn precipices, on cobbled, snaking roadways carved into the vertical slopes. Villages that are a few miles apart by air are an hour apart by road. A gentle toss will carry a stone thousands of feet down. It takes 8 hours to drive 30 miles. Lush, terraced fields stretch from oceanside valleys up the slopes until they reach vertical rock. Farmers harvest grapes for famous Madeira wine, bananas and other fruits of every variety, including some found only on this mystical isle. We investigate a village perched high upon a ridge over the sea. Melodies from Catherine's flute intertwine with a northerly breeze that sweeps up the slopes, bringing with it the music of crashing surf. Elegant peaks, soft valleys, and tranquil people combine in a fairy tale setting. It is Sunday. There is no electricity, no TV football, no video games. The people of the village line the street, occasionally shifting position with their neighbors to gossip or simply to look on while life passes by. The island's natural wealth allows this tranquility. Water springs everywhere. I want a beer. Abierto, señor? He is not supposed to be open, but we are special. The bar is the basement of an ancient house. Its damp rock walls cool us. A tap pokes out from one wall. A large wooden cask sits dimly lit in the back. Spiced tomato sauce filled with tender beef boils atop a corner stove. The man gives us beer and fills glasses with wine from the cask. It's new wine from his vineyard. He hands me a sandwich of the spiced meat, too. He welcomes us into his life as if we are old friends, but we do not stay. I must get on to the Canaries. We originally planned on a 2-week voyage, but winds have been light. Catherine and I have been together for over a month. She is a good crew, eager to learn, but she expects more. She expects all men to love her. It is an odd turnabout from the usual female complaint. All my captain wants to do is get me into the sack. To Catherine I am aloof and silent. You are a hard man, she continually tells me. It is probably true. Most of the women I've been close to have been very liberated types. I have always respected that, but in turn I've demanded much from them. I have demanded that I should not be subjected to female chauvinism, that I should not be duty-bound to do all the man's work. So when Catherine has been on watch, and a jib or pole has fouled, and she has implored me for help, I have snapped at her. When it's your watch, you deal with it. But I know that my hardness is more than this. My impatience and unkindness stem from deeper roots. 7 years of marriage ending in divorce, and an ensuing hot relationship that left me singed, have made me tired of the traumas of women and of love. Perhaps it is a fear that I am unwilling to face. Perhaps I have traded my quest for love for the quest to finish what I set out to do. I don't really know. But these are among the secrets that I'm unwilling to share with Catherine, despite her soft French voice and lovable smiles. I only want to sail, write, and draw. If anything, as our voyage lengthens and the more she tries to soften me up, the harder I become. I want my boat back to myself. As if I'm afraid of the magic that the tranquility of Madeira is spinning, I set sail after only 3 days. Was I wrong? Safe harbors. That's what I want now. Why did I push on? Why did I not allow myself to soften? I'm determined to taste campfire biscuits again, to feel cool streams. I will build another ship and give myself another chance to feel the warmth of human passion. I do not think of if I get home, but only when I get home. I was foolish to let those Dorados escape. The butcher shop is bare. My stomach churns and growls in anguish. I hunt my companions for days on end. I begin to recognize many. One still trails a fishing line from its mouth. Another has a torn fin. Another a large gash in its back that is slowly scarring over. There are differences in size and slight variations in color. The females differ markedly from the males. They are slimmer, smaller, with more rounded foreheads. I often see two very distinctive bright green fish that never approach closely. The female is over 4 feet long, the male even bigger. Dorados up to 6 feet long, weighing 60 pounds, have been recorded. The emerald elders are as wary of me as I am of them. The youngsters ignore their warnings and come close to the raft, still cautious. They know where I can shoot, and they avoid these areas or sneak by when I'm not looking. They slowly swim into range and then dart this way or that. These fish are not stupid, and they can swim at 50 knots, making them the fastest fish alive. The emerald elders leap yards through the air and land with a thunderous slap. I would not be surprised to see them suddenly take off in flight. It is as if their play is a statement to me. Behold the magnificence that our race can attain. Yet these fish are modest creatures. They say nothing and swim on. Finally, I manage to spear a triggerfish. The tiny fillets are little comfort, but she is full of sweet eggs. My body seems to immediately revive from the nutrients. A third ship approaches, but farther off. I fire a flare. It passes. I now have only 2 meteor, 2 smoke, and 2 parachute flares left. The ships have been eastbound 3 or 4 days apart. I must be near the lanes. Perhaps I'll be lucky the fourth time. February 26th, day 22. It is February 26th, my 22nd day adrift. I cannot complain too much, as the morning has been relatively good. The raft is moving well. The sun is out. My second Dorado lies slain before me. My cleaning of the Dorados has become more thorough. I don't waste anything. I eat the heart and liver, suck the fluid from the eyes, and break the backbone to get the gelatinous nuggets from between the vertebrae. I have rationed myself only a half pint of drinking water per day, so I have built up my stock to 6.5 pints. I am clear-headed and the raft is holding up. I'm feeling okay. But I am very conscious that my spirits fall and rise with the undulating waves. Then the afternoon sun focuses on me. Magnified as if through a glass, it seems to burn holes in my chest. I struggle to my knees in order to tend the still and look around. Dizziness overtakes me, nearly knocking me over as darkness closes in on the edges of my vision. All is blue and hazy as I fumble for the coffee can and pour water over my scalp. I collapse, vaguely seeing waves press ahead to my destination. Like a thunderclap, the windward side of the raft crushes in upon me, flips forward, and the bow digs into the sea. Water pours in. This is it, capsize, I think calmly. But the stern pops back into shape and flops down. About 20 gallons of water slosh around me. My sleeping bag, some notes, the cushion, and other gear float about. The rogue wave melts into the distance ahead, a messenger signaling that worse is to follow. The flooding has revived me from catatonic lethargy. Mechanically, I set to the exhausting work of bailing and wringing out. Another 3 days of cold, wet gear. My sleeping bag is already a bundle of knots and lumps, encrusted with salt when dry. It is hard work just to wring out most of the water and get the bag to the merely wet stage. In the ensuing evenings, the crinkly, clammy space blanket will provide my best cover. My scabs have been torn off again. The suddenness of these sieges by the sea and its creatures gives me no quarter. I stand, face the growing wind and seas, and support my wobbly legs by holding on to the canopy. Waves jostle my platform and gurgle about my feet. Cirrus clouds mat the sky like shaggy white dog hair dropped from the heavens. Things are getting bleaker both inside and out. I try to keep a positive perspective. The essentials, food, water, shelter, are being maintained. My mind is sometimes free to wander and to make my life more than here and now. I am the past. I am what others have known and felt about me. I am the things I have done. These are my afterlife. These cannot be captured or killed. I know this is only temporary reassurance, but I am inspired enough to regularly get up off my cushion, feel the cold air against my skin, and survey my surroundings. I cannot afford to miss a passing ship. I find a small hole in the second still, tape it up, and get it temporarily working again, continuing to build my water stock. No matter how positive I tried to be, approaching scud and wind blow upon me the fear of another gale. February 27th, day 23. By morning the wind is whistling. The heaving seas raises 10-foot waves which spew, curl, and crash down. I hang on to windward wrapped in my salty sleeping bag. In quick darts to the downwind side, I tend to the solar still and snatch a glance about. Watchkeeping is a joke. The visible horizon is very close. I stand and balance as well as I can on the rubber floor, rising and falling with the waves. As a raft is elevated to the peak of a wave, I bend my knees to compensate for the liftoff. We hesitate for a moment on the top before plunging down into the trough. During this brief pause, my eyes sweep across a segment of the horizon. It takes a couple of minutes of rising and plummeting before I get a clear look all around. Every now and then I get a glimpse of something off to the north, but the massive rolling shoulders and white foamy heads of waves crowd my view. Finally, I'm lifted to the top of a big roller. Yes, there she is, a ship, northbound. Unfortunately, there's no hope of her picking me up. She's pointed away from me and too distant to spot a flare. I am encouraged only by her direction, South Africa to New York. What was merely a dream 24 desperate days ago, I have made real. I have reached the lanes and I still live. 5. To weave a world. The metal is hard and cold. After an hour of leaning over the bulwark, my elbows are in icy pain. I stand and thrust my hands deep into the wool coat the captain has brought me. "I'll bet you never thought you'd see this city again," he says, looking at me quizzically. I peruse the horizon. It is no longer flat and empty, but is full of monolithic skyscrapers, gray smog. The noise of the city rises above even the rumble of reversed engines. Heavy, tattooed arms pull aboard hawsers as thick as thighs and whip them around the capstans. Slowly the ship is worked into the dock. More and more lines are tossed and set. The water eddies around us. The behemoth is reeled in. No, I never thought I'd see New York again. Then there is darkness and chaos. My head is struck with a club, cold, wet, and hard. The assaulter roars, rumbles, and rolls away into the night. I am on the dark side of the earth, a quarter world away from New York. The wind is up and so is the sea. Rubber Ducky lurches and crashes as if caught in a demolition derby. Still here, I moan. Each night, soft fabrics caress my skin. The smell of food fills my nostrils, and warm bodies surround me. Sometimes, while wrapped in sleep, I hear my conscious mind bark a warning. Enjoy it while you can, for you will soon awaken. I am used to the duality of it. Usually when I sail alone, the sounds of fluttering sails and waves, the motion of my boat rising and plunging, never leave me, even as I hang in my bunk dreaming of faraway places. If a movement varies slightly, or an unfamiliar noise slaps against my eardrum, I am immediately awakened. Yet last night's dream was almost too real. My life has become a composition of multi-layered realities, daydreams, night dreams, and the seemingly endless physical struggle. I keep trying to believe that all of these realities are equal. Perhaps they are, in some ultimate sense. But it becomes increasingly obvious that in the survival world, my physical self and my instincts are the ringmasters that whip all of my realities into place and control their motions. My dreams and daydreams are filled with images of what my body requires and of how to escape from this physical hell. Since I have gotten the still to work and have learned how to fish more efficiently, there has been little to do but save energy, wait, and dream. Slowly, though, I find I am becoming more starved and desperate. My equipment is deteriorating. I must work harder and longer each day to weave a world in which I can live. Survival is the play. I want the leading role. The script sounds simple enough. Hang on, ration food and water, fish, and tend the still. But each little nuance of my role takes on profound significance. If I keep watch too closely, I will tire and be no good for fishing, tending the still, or other essential tasks. Yet every moment that I don't have my eyes on the horizon is a moment when a ship may pass me. If I use both stills now, I may be able to quench my thirst and keep myself in better shape for keeping watch and doing jobs. But if they both wear out, I will die of thirst. My mind applauds some of my performances, while my body boos, or vice versa. It is a constant struggle to keep control, self-discipline, to maintain a course of action that will best ensure survival, because I can't be sure what that course is. Is my command making the right decisions? Might immediate gratification sometimes be the best course to follow, even in the long run? More often than not, all I can tell myself is, you're doing the best you can. I need more fish, and the constant nudging I feel through the floor of the raft tells me that the Dorados are around in sufficient numbers to make fishing a reasonable expenditure of energy. After several misfires, I finally skewer a Dorado by the tail, but it doesn't slow him down much. He yanks the raft all over the place while I frantically try to hold on, wishing that I could train these fish to pull me in the direction I want to go. He pulls free before I can get him aboard. Oh well, try again. I start to reset the spear gun, but the power strap is gone, now sinking through 3 miles of seawater. This could be real trouble. It's my first major gear failure, but I've dealt with a lot of jury rigs before, so I should be able to figure something out. It's always a challenge to try and repair an essential system with what one has at hand. In fact, I sometimes wonder if one of the major reasons for ocean racing and voyaging is to push oneself and one's boat just past the edge, watch things fail, and then somehow come up with a solution. In many ways, having a jury rig succeed is often more gratifying than making a pleasant and uneventful passage, or even winning a race. Rising to the challenge is a common thread that runs through a vast wardrobe of sea stories. I've stuck back together mast, steering gear, boat hulls, and a host of smaller items. Although I don't have much to work with, repairing the spear should be relatively simple. The important thing is to keep calm. The small details of the repair will determine its success or failure. As always, I can only afford success. Don't hurry. Make it right. You can fish tomorrow. The arrow and the gun handle are still intact. It is only the source of power that is missing. I put the arrow on the shaft of the handle in the normal manner, but I pull the arrow out through the plastic loop on the end of the handle shaft in order to lengthen the weapon as much as possible. I wind 2 long lashings around the arrow and shaft. I use the heavy cod line, which is better than synthetic line because it shrinks when it is wetted and then dried, thereby tightening the lashings. The smooth arrow still rotates, so I add a 3rd lashing. Then I add frappings to the lashings. These are turns of line around the lashings at right angles. When pulled tight, the frappings cinch up the lashings and should keep them from spreading out haphazardly. There are notches in the butt of the arrow, which normally fit into the trigger mechanism in the handle. Through these notches and back through the trigger housing, I pass loops of line to keep the arrow from being pulled out forward by an escaping fish. I am aware that my repaired spear is a flimsy rig for catching Dorados. Normally, a diver pulls in his spear gun arrow when retrieving a fish. I must drive my lance through the fish, putting the rig in compression rather than tension. When I pull a fish out of the water, it will put a large bending load on the arrow as well. However, my new lance feels pretty sturdy, and I'm ready to try it out. Patience is going to be the secret, and strength. Power was stored in the elastic power strap. Now the improvised spear has to be thrust at a moment's notice with all of the power I can muster if I'm to drive through a thick Dorado. I lean my left elbow on the top tube of the raft to steady my aim, and I lightly rest the arrow of the spear between my fingers. I pull the gun handle high up onto my cheek with my right arm tensed and steady, awaiting the perfect shot. I can sight down the shaft, and rocking back and forth gives me a narrow field of fire. On the water's surface is an imaginary circle about a foot in diameter into which I can shoot without moving my steadying elbow off of the raft tube. If I am not well braced, my shots will become wild. The effective range of the spear has been shortened from about 6 feet to 3 or 4. I must wait until a fish swims directly under my point so that it will be in range and the problem of surface refraction, which makes the fish appear to be where it is not, will be minimized. This problem is extreme at oblique angles to the water. When I shoot, I must extend my range and power as much as possible. I thrust my arm out straight and lunge as hard as I can with my whole body, trying to hold my aim. The shot must be instantaneous, because the fish are so quick and agile, but it also must be perfectly controlled. Once I lift my left steadying arm off of the tube, it becomes hopeless. I watch the fish swimming all over the place, but I must wait for one to swim within my field of fire. I remain poised for minutes that stretch into hours at a time. I feel like I'm becoming an ancient bronze statue of a bowless archer. The doggy's nudging has become an advantage. I push my knees deeply into the floor just behind my arrow, luring them on. Bump, and a body slithers out, a little too far to starboard. Bump, a little too far to port. Head center, do it, splash, strike, ripping strong pull, white water, a cloud of blood. He's in the air, huge, a spray of blood, ow! Feels like I'm being smashed by an oar as he slides down the spear toward me. Don't let go. Get him in, quick. Fury flapping, blood flying. Watch the spear tip. The tip, fool. On the floor. Onto him now. The huge square-headed body lies still for a moment under my knee as I press my full weight down on him. His gills are puffing in rhythm with my gasps as I try to grasp the spear on both sides of his torso and give myself a moment's rest. A hole as big as my fist has been blasted out of his body, which stretches almost all the way across the floor. Globs of clotting blood swill about in the crater created by my other knee. Whap, 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 his thunder-clapping tail smashes into action. I'm knocked over backward. He's escaped. The tip, watch the tip. He flops all around the raft, making for the exit. Pain in my wrist, pain in my face. He's winning. I fumble for the tip of the spear as it whips about. Finally, I tackle the fish, throw him down onto my sleeping bag and equipment sack, and bury the spear tip in the thick fabric. Both of us are panting. I can't reach my knife. His eye clicks around, calculating. Little time left, and he knows it. Whap, whap, whap. He's off again. Look out. Fire shoots up my left arm. Get down there. Down. Whap, whap, cracking around the raft like a bullwhip. Back on the bag again, sprawled across him, pushing with my legs to get him pinned, gills puffing. Get the knife in. Push it in. Hit something hard, the spine. Twist it. Crack. Wait. He's still panting. Slowly panting. Stopped panting. Rest. I'll not do that again. I can't believe that the raft hasn't been ripped. I examine the spear carefully. It is only slightly bent, and the lashings held. I listen but hear no hissing leaks. The tubes still feel hard. Blood and guts are spewed everywhere, some of it mine, no doubt. I'll try to stick to the smaller females in the future. Also, from now on I will carefully arrange my equipment before beginning to fish. I'll stretch out the sailcloth across as much of the bottom as possible, put my cutting board down, and spread my sleeping bag over the tubes on the starboard half of the raft above my equipment sack. I have overcome the first serious gear failure since I coaxed the solar still to work. For hours I slice up my grand fish. First I hack it into four large chunks, plus the head and tail. Then I slice each chunk into four long pieces, one from each side of the back and one from each side of the belly. Finally I slice these into sticks which I hang on strings to dry, like dozens of fat fingers, delicious fat fingers. I write in my log that this is a strange prison in which I am slowly starved, but occasionally thrown a 20-pound filet mignon. The first week of my unplanned raft voyage has gone well as can be expected. I escaped the immediate peril of solo sinking, have adjusted to my equipment and to the environment, and am now actually better stocked with food and water than when I began. So much for the positive side. The negative is only too obvious. Lack of starches, sugars, and vitamins has let my body wither. My gluteus maximus was the first to go. Where my plump ass once was, there are only hollows of flesh ridged by pelvic bones. I tried to stand as often and as long as possible, but my legs have badly atrophied and hang from my hips like threads with little knots for knees. There was a time when three hands could not encircle my thighs. Now two will do, and nicely at that. My chest and arms have thinned but remain fairly strong due to the exercise demanded by survival. How the body steals heat or food from one part to lend to another, how it compensates for deprivation by shutting down all but the essential systems, how it possibly can keep this wreck running in this demo derby of flesh is all beyond me, amazing, almost amusing. I write in my log, "No more fat on this honky." The cuts on my knees still have not healed. Other gashes have left thick scars. Dozens of small slits in my hands made by my knife or fishbones never seem to mend. Scar tissue builds up around the wounds like little volcanoes, leaving raw craters inside. Though I'm meticulous about sponging up water and keeping Ducky dry, I've spent about half of my time wet. The salt water sores begin as small, infected boils that grow, burst open, and leave ulcers penetrating the skin. These continue to widen and deepen, as if a slow-burning acid were being dropped on the flesh. But so far, my work at keeping dry has paid off. I have only a dozen or two open sores, about a quarter inch across, clustered on my hips and ankles. My cushion and sleeping bag, when dry, are encrusted with salt, which grinds into my wounds. March 3rd, Day 27. It is sunrise of the 27th day since I began my voyage in Rubber Ducky 3. I roll and tie up the canopy's entry closure so its cold, wet skin won't lash across mine. I poke my head out, turn aft, and watch the rising sun as awestruck as a child witnessing it for the first time. I note its position relative to the raft. Creases in Ducky's soft tubes open and close like toothless black mouths munching on strings of glue and white chalk markings of the raft inspectors. Sometimes I wonder who made these marks and what they are doing now. I hope that they are well, for they've done a good job, and I am grateful. I push the pump hose into the hard white valves and begin my work, a job as thankless and never-ending as washing dishes, and as tiring as a marathon. Ringed treads on the pump have worn thick calluses into my thumbs. The bellows utters a short, high-pitched whimper each time I squeeze it, like those baby dolls that cry out and weep tears. One, two, three, four. 57, 58, 59, 60. I pause, panting, feel the tube, not quite as firm as a watermelon yet, and continue. Then the bottom tube. Noontime, sunset, midnight, and morning, I squeeze the crying pump. In the early days, I had to listen to only 60 whimpers each day. Now I have to squeeze over 300 from the hateful little beast. The still is sagging. Each morning I blow it up, empty the salt water from the distillate, and prime it. Then I get up to take a look around. Tricky. On a ship's solid deck, the waves' motions are averaged out. Here my legs fall and rise with every ripple. Tiny bubbles and gurgles tickle the bottoms of my soft feet. Their calluses washed off long ago. I hang lightly onto the canopy, conscious that a hard tug may collapse it and drop me into the sea. Standing up in my vessel is a little like walking on water. The only companions in sight are a petrel and a graceful shearwater. The petrel looks as out of place as I, fluttering like a sea chickadee, teetering on the edge of flight, heading straight for a clumsy crash. In reality, he's having no trouble. I've seen petrels in shrieking winds flapping from one gigantic wave canyon to another. They weigh only a few ounces, and you'd think they'd be blown off the face of the world. The tiny petrels, even the much larger shearwaters, will make a very meager meal, but I'll still try to grab one if it ventures close enough. Neither has any need for my dangerous company. They are only curious enough to swoop by every now and then. Their minute black eyes flit over every detail of the raft as they pass. I can watch the flight of shearwaters for hours. They rarely flap their wings, even when it is flat calm. Then they glide in a straight line close to the surface of the water in order to use the surface effect. In heavy airs, they wheel about in large arcs and then dive down so close to the waves that you can't see any space between their feather tips and the water. To me, they are the gods of grace. The shearwaters make me feel very clumsy and remind me how ill-suited I am to this domain. Robertson's book includes tables of the sun's declination, which I use to fix my direction at sunrise. I can do the same at sunset. At night I can fix my heading from both the North Star and Southern Cross. The heavens have provided me with an unbreakable, immortal, fully guaranteed compass. To measure my speed, I time the passage of seaweed between Rubber Ducky and the man overboard pole. Earlier, I had calculated the distance to the pole to be about 70 feet, or 1/90th of a nautical mile. If it takes 1 minute for a piece of weed or other flotsam to pass between Ducky and the pole, I am going 60/90th of a nautical mile each hour, or 2/3 of a knot, which works out to 16 miles a day. I make up a table for times from 25 to 100 seconds, 9.5 to 38 miles a day. I never do see a 38-mile day. Since my chart shows the entire Atlantic Ocean on one sheet, my snail's pace progress is hardly worth plotting on a daily basis, but every couple of days I plot another 1/8 or 1/4 inch. I kid myself that I only have a little ways left to travel, why it's only about 6 inches on the map. I am confident that we, that is Ducky and I, have reached the lanes and will soon be picked up. But we may well have drifted beyond them. I have tried the EPIRB again to no avail. The battery must be very low now. I must wait until I see positive signs of land or air traffic before I try it again. As soon as we arrived at what I thought was the edge of the lanes, the wind strengthened. Perhaps Zephyrus wants to push us through before we can be spotted. I'm not too disappointed. It's a relief to be moving purposefully forward. There have been no sharks. There has been only one ship in 6 days. Pretty empty ocean highway. Conditions are favorable for my tub. It's blowing hard enough to move us well, but not so hard that the waves are blasted apart. Unless we are hit by a rogue wave, Ducky will stay on her bottom. She slews down the slopes with a speedy motion that is smooth, quiet, and peaceful, seemingly frictionless. I get a vision in my head that I can't shake, one of a spaceship gliding in large, curving banks through the vastness of space. In my log, I sketch Rubber Ducky converted to a flying saucer with a wide band around her perimeter studded with lights. I surround her with planets, stars, and fish. Time for breakfast. I fall back on my cushion and lean up against the equipment sack. I flip my sleeping bag over my legs, awaiting the warmth of the day. The fish sticks that have been hanging for 2 days are semi-dried and slightly chewy. Dorados begin their own daily routine, bumping my rear several times before flipping off to hunt. 8 hard-won pints of water are carefully stored in 3 unopened water tins, 2 recapped and taped tins, 2 distillate plastic bags, and my working water jug. The butcher shop is chock-a-block full of fish sticks. Wet, fresh protein is digested with less water than cooked or dried meat, so I try to eat a lot of my catch early on. As days pass and it gets chewier, I carefully ration the meat and begin fishing again. I've become worried about my digestive tract. Dougal Robertson points to the case of one